With the latest in agriculture news from across the state and the country, it's Farm City News Day. And here's your host, Sabrina Hill.
Good morning. Thanks for turning on your radio this morning for your agriculture news. Today is Thursday, September 28th. Coming up in today's show, what does California rice stand to gain once shipments begin to reach the Chinese market? More on that in a moment, but first, some lawmakers believe Congress may soon resolve funding issues related to wildlife suppression efforts, especially after this historic wildfire season. Here's Rod Bain with more.
U.S. Forest Service headquarters in Washington, D.C. played host Tuesday to Agriculture Secretary Sonny Perdue and a congressional delegation working together to address wildfire suppression funding issues. In particular, the end of borrowing from other fire funds designated for maintenance when catastrophic wildfires take place. And one senator involved in this issue for several years, Oregon's Ron Wyden, told reporters,
"We have never had a better shot at finally getting fire borrowing ended than we do in this upcoming period when we're going to have another disaster package."
Due to growing awareness of both the severity and ability to prevent such a disaster, Senator James Risch of Idaho explains,
"This is at least partially preventable and almost fully manageable. So with the expenditure of funds ahead of time rather than after, you can actually accomplish tamping down the catastrophic effects of the event."
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
The Environmental Working Group is paying close attention to the process of developing the new Farm Bill. Craig Cox, Senior Vice President for Agriculture and Natural Resources, says the conservation provisions of the Farm Bill represent a big opportunity to help farmers deal with more serious issues they're going to face regarding quality of life.
Drinking water issues, drinking water that's contaminated with nitrates or other sources that are linked to runoff from farming operations are becoming more and more of an issue. Algal blooms, toxic or otherwise, it just seems to me that the issues around farming and the environment are beginning to touch the public in ways that are much more direct than used to be in the olden days.
The EWG would like to see the conservation title organized to help agriculture get in front of what could become difficult environmental issues to deal with. The group builds a database that shows what conservation programs are funding in terms of conservation practices in every county across the country. They say conservation programs need more focus.
It seems like the programs could be far more focused and really focused on supporting farmers to use the most effective conservation practices in the right places. And in too many instances, it looks like that's not what's happening. That's the bad news part. The good news part is that it looks like there's huge room for improvement in the performance of those conservation programs.
Cox says those changes to the conservation program could be implemented with small changes. The group is putting together a study of the nation's drinking water utilities and communities with elevated levels of nitrates. They're using the data to see if the protective practices that would reduce nitrate loading are the ones given priority. Cox says that's not the case.
38-some% of these communities are located in counties where neither CSP or the Environmental Quality Incentives Program are encouraging farmers to use the practices we know, that scientists know, reduce the nitrate in the water used for drinking.
He says some of the things they want emphasized in the new Farm Bill include cover crops as part of the conservation title.
Getting grassed waterways or contour strips on the ground to prevent ephemeral gully erosion would be high on the list. Keeping some perennial vegetation a buffer between cropland and waterways would be on the list. And, you know, really restricting winter application of manure would be also high on the list.
The Environmental Working Group also thinks it's time to renegotiate the conservation compliance provisions in the conservation title. Specialty Crop News, brought to you by the Almond Board of California. Find them online at almonds.com. The Almond Board is reminding growers about the Seeds for Bees program by Project APIS-M. Billy Sink, Director of Pollination Programs with Project APIS-M, tells us more about the program.
This program is designed to help out almond growers here in California produce a better crop more efficiently, helping their soil and helping the bees all at the same time. It is kind of a win-win-win scenario. cover crops, particularly the ones that we've selected for the Seeds for Bees program, offer a wide range of benefits to the grower. They can increase organic matter, increase water availability, suppress weeds, prevent erosion. They increase nitrogen. They help decompose mummy nuts. And they do all this while providing nutrition for bees as well.
He says growers don't need to have a lot of land available.
No, they don't. The Seeds for Bees program is open to growers of all different sizes, from very small family farms to quite larger, more corporate farms. We do have a limit of how much we can send each person. We try to spread these funds as wide as possible. So if a grower wants additional seed, they can always purchase our seed, not from us, but from the seed company we work with.
To learn more about the program and get your free cover crop seeds, you can contact SYNC directly at billy@projectapismm.org. This is Farm City Newsday by AgNet West. I'm your host, Sabrina Hill. We will be back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
Set sail for Madison, Wisconsin and discover new dairy worlds October 3rd through the 7th at the 2017 World Dairy Expo. For 5 days, the global dairy industry meets at the Align Energy Center to view the finest dairy cattle and dairy trade shows in North America. Virtual farm tours, expo seminars, youth contests, and social activities make Expo an ideal location for learning and networking. Visit worlddairyexpo.com to plan your trip today.
The Citrus Research Board invites the citrus industry to attend this year's California Citrus Conference on Wednesday, October 11th in Visalia. Join the CRB at 7:30 for registration and a free breakfast. Sessions kick off at 9 with a focus on ACP control and HLB early detection technologies. California Ag Secretary Karen Ross will address attendees, followed by a free barbecue lunch. Afternoon sessions include post-harvest technologies, biocontrol, and the very latest in citrus breeding and varieties. Pre-register for this free conference online at citrusresearch.org.
Your local DuPont Pioneer team doesn't take with you from the word go lightly, especially when it comes to forages. Just ask your fellow producers, folks like Amos Smith.
We have an awesome support team from Pioneer. I think that they're probably one of the reasons why we are successful.
And Bruce Cullum.
They'll come out just anytime you want to call them and help us. You don't get that from all your other seed dealers, but these guys are here all season long.
As well as Ken Felt.
Just know that, you know, the research that Pioneer's done, it really, it shows, and the cows really do well with it, so we continue to use it.
Or Billy Rucker.
All in all, you know, seem like Pioneer is always in the top. I bleed green, and I bleed Pioneer.
Want a team that's with you from the word go? That's DuPont Pioneer. Ask them about leveraging the silage zone resource to produce the highest quality forages for your operation. Pioneer, with you from the word go.
Welcome back to Farm City Newsday by AgNet West. Here's Brian German.
As National Rice Month comes to an end, many California growers are eagerly waiting for the Chinese market to officially open, bringing with it substantial demand. Since 2013, China has been the largest importer of rice, taking in close to 5 million tons last year. California's proximity to China offers a bit of an advantage over other rice producers in the U.S., and President and CEO of the California Rice Commission, Tim Johnson, explained another benefit to California-grown rice.
We also grow a different kind of rice here in California, and it's in some ways complementary to rice that's grown in the rest of the United States. It's also very unique. It's short and medium grain, stickier rice. Is the Japonica rice like you would find at sushi or Korean rice bowls. Really, California grows that rice exceptionally well. And we think that our proximity and the specialty rice that we grow has a real opportunity in China.
I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
Pork is the number one consumed protein worldwide. The three National Pork Board executive officers and two members of the senior leadership team participated in a trade mission to Japan and China. The National Pork Board Treasurer, Brett Kaysen, says U.S. pork is well recognized in the meat case in Japan. The Colorado producer said the U.S. can learn from the Japanese when it comes to marketing to the consumer.
I think we have the opportunity for more branding of our product specifically, not only as U.S. pork, but more of telling the story from farm to fork. The Japanese people really appreciate knowing who the farmer, the pig farmer, the producer is behind the product, And they like to see signs with the face of the farmer, a story behind the farm, whether that be in traditional signage on the meat case or even in a short video. And so I think we can learn from that, because I see the American producers gaining some capital by branding their program and make a connection back to the consumer relative to we as farmers and what we do for a living.
This trade team was also able to get a firsthand look at the Japanese processing sector. Kaysen says it was impressive.
A phenomenal experience at the Tokyo meat market. If I can frame it up for you verbally and try to let you imagine visually what this looks like, you're essentially in downtown Tokyo, and you're looking at a building that would look from the outside something like a hospital structure. And that's actually the Tokyo meat market. You would never guess that they're fabricating hogs in there. You would never guess that there's any live animals coming into this facility. And quite frankly, it was the cleanest meat processing facility I've ever been in, or meat harvesting facility. They actually create those pigs into whole carcasses and then sell them as a whole carcass. And I have never been in a plant that was that organized and that clean, to the point where as you walk in the plant, you actually walk through a device that's like a giant human hair dryer, if you will. And phenomenal organization, phenomenal sanitation and cleanliness, and I appreciated that. And that goes with the Japanese culture. As I said before, as you work through Tokyo, it's a big, big, big city, but extremely organized and very, very clean. And so I learned some things from them in terms of food safety specs and HACCP and standard operating procedures that I think we can continue to improve on in the U.S. as well.
After 5 days in Japan, the delegation traveled to China. We'll have more about that part of the trip in upcoming reports.
Well, in today's livestock news, the National Milk Producers Federation, or NMPF, told the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency that the dairy industry supports a two-step process to roll back the existing Waters of the U.S. or WOTUS regulation and generate a new policy that provides farmers greater certainty in the future. According to an NMPF release, they have supported efforts by the Trump administration since January to restart the regulatory process behind the controversial 2015 WOTUS rule. NMPF provided comments this week to EPA in support of rescinding the 2015 rule so the agency can initiate a new regulatory process defining and regulating groundwater sources. Jamie Yonker, NMPF Vice President for Sustainability and Scientific Affairs, wrote in comments to EPA, "A fresh start and a more reasonable approach that complies with past Supreme Court rulings will be in the best interest of the environment and dairy farmers. We are committed to working with the EPA and Army Corps of Engineers to find effective ways to protect America's water supply." Well, the U.S. Meat Export Federation recently hosted a team of European beef buyers. Joe Sheely has that story.
Yuri Barutkin, USMEF representative in the region, has more details in this USMEF report.
We had representatives from Sweden, Norway, Finland, representing Scandinavia, and we had Czech Republic, Poland, Romania, Bulgaria, and Latvia representing Central and Eastern Europe. They were not direct importers of U.S. beef, but the distributors of U.S. beef in their home countries. Most of their clients would be the food service companies, but some of the clients were actually distributors to retail outlets as well. So because they sell a very niche product and a very high-end product, they need to see the story behind U.S. beef so they can see why it is so special and pass that knowledge to their clients in their home countries.
While U.S. beef middle meats sell very well in Europe, Barutkin notes that one of the objectives of the visit was to build demand for more economically priced alternative cuts.
So apart from just seeing the slaughter facilities, seeing the farms, the feedlots, we also paid a lot of attention to the science behind U.S. beef and what makes it so special. We were hosted by the University of Nebraska, where people could get the scientific knowledge into what is behind the U.S. beef. One of the things that we were trying to achieve was to give much more knowledge to them about the alternative cuts and the way they're being used in the United States, the gastronomical and culinary experiences with alternative cuts, because I think this is where we can achieve much more in the European market. And if we can manage to find the best distribution of the cuts, that would help U.S. beef industry to maximize the value of the carcass that they sell in the European Union.
For more information, please visit usmef.org. For the U.S. Meat Export Federation, I'm Joe Sheely.
Thanks, Joe, and I'm Randall Wiseman for AgNet West. AgriView with Evergreiner is next.
U.S. farmland is still coveted by foreigners. There are some new figures out that gives a glimpse of how much U.S. farmland is owned by foreigners and who they are. Let's start here. Between 2004 and 2014, foreign ownership of American farmland doubled to slightly over 27 million acres. Well, how much is that? Well, it's less than the state of Mississippi. In one way, that's a lot of land, but in another, it isn't. It's mostly in woodlands and pasture. Actually, the farm volume is just over 20%. Now, who are these foreigners? Well, they represent several countries, but they're mostly Canadians and Dutch. So, although it sounds like we're selling our country, our land to other countries, it's just a small portion. Kind of like sticking the end of your little finger into a 10-inch pie. And that's Ag Review for today. Everett Griner, AgNet West.
Coming up in a few moments, we have Kathy Isom with today's This Land of Ours report and today's California Kitchen. But first, today is World Rabies Day. Rabies is still a human public health problem worldwide, though the United States is an example of ways where the numbers can be brought down drastically. Stephanie Ho has more on the story.
Rabies is a problem around the world.
From a global perspective, circulation of rabies in domestic dogs is the most pressing public health problem because of the close companion nature of dogs with humans. When there's circulation in domestic dogs, you have a lot of cases in humans.
That was Amy Gilbert, project leader for the Rabies Research Project at USDA's Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service, or APHIS. She says there are about 60,000 human fatalities due to rabies each year.
Most of the 60,000 cases occur in Africa and in Asia. And so domestic dogs are still a very important reservoir of the virus and source of the virus circulation.
She says this worldwide number contrasts sharply with the number of human rabies deaths in the United States.
Since we are in the United States considered canine rabies free, we don't have very many human cases of rabies each year. On average, there's probably about 2 to 4 cases of human rabies each year in the United States.
Why are the numbers so low? Jordana Kirby, a field coordinator with the National Rabies Management Program, has some recent history of the evolution of rabies in the United States.
Beginning in the 1980s, it became a trend such that wildlife started to account for more than 90% of cases reported in the U.S. on an annual basis. Prior to that time, a majority of cases reported in the U.S. annually occurred in domestic species such as dogs and cats.
She points to specific steps that have helped bring that number down.
But over time, through increased vaccination efforts as well as regulation and leash laws, we began to see a shift.
The shift she's talking about is how rabies in the United States became more prevalent among wild animals, including bats, raccoons, and skunks.
In the eastern U.S., through the Northeast, as well as the Mid-Atlantic and the Southeast, raccoons absolutely make up the number one species in which we see rabies cases every year.
She says raccoons pose a threat to people because they like to be near them and are tolerated in areas where humans tend to congregate.
With raccoons being one of the number one species in which cases are reported every year, it creates a little bit more of a challenge because they do thrive in human environments in the eastern U.S. where we have high human population centers.
She says authorities are not only working on improving rabies vaccines for raccoons, they hope to completely eliminate raccoon rabies in the United States within 30 years. Meanwhile, for countries that are not as fortunate as the United States, Amy Gilbert emphasizes the importance of raising public awareness.
In some areas, folks may not be aware that they could vaccinate their animals, or they may not be aware that an effective vaccine exists for humans.
The vaccines do work, but in order for them to work, they have to be administered before the disease reaches the nervous system. This is Stephanie Hove in Washington, D.C.
The cost of preparing a fall meal increased in the latest survey of food prices by the American Farm Bureau Federation. Michael Clements has more.
The American Farm Bureau Federation's Fall Harvest Market Basket Survey found the total cost of 16 foods that can be used to prepare 7 meals was $51.13. The cost is up $1.43, or about 3%, from the survey results a year ago. AFBF Director of Market Intelligence John Newton says higher retail prices for several foods, including bacon, chicken breast, and orange juice, were behind the increase.
Bacon prices increased significantly, and we also saw orange juice prices up quite a bit from where they were last year. We did see some prices come down from where they were last year, most notably salad mix. The drought last year in California really pushed salad and lettuce prices up. and we've seen some relief in those prices this year.
He says the prices included in the survey reflect consumer demand. For example, consumers are purchasing more bacon, driving supplies down and prices up.
If you think about what's happening in the food service sector, consumers are enjoying more fatty foods. And bacon is the sexy food item at the restaurant and at the retail space. Bacon inventories this year are down from where they were in prior year levels. And as a result, we saw pork belly prices rise to highs we haven't seen in recent years. And that's reflected in those retail bacon prices.
The Fall Harvest Market Basket Survey is part of four food price trend surveys conducted by AFBF during the year. Compared to 6 months ago, when the cost of a summer cookout came in at $50.03, the overall cost of the market basket items increased by about 2%. The full results of the Fall Harvest Survey are available at www.fb.org. Michael Clements reporting.
It's time for My Dad, Trent Luce, and today's Luce Tale.
I don't believe anybody would question the uncertainty that exists in the farm economy today. I can't speak really well for the fruit and vegetable crops being grown by our friends in the number one agricultural state, California. I can tell you that soybean and corn producers, the farmers in the midsection of the United States, are quite certain this is not going to be one of their better years. In fact, rivaling what we witnessed in the 80s as I was just myself getting active on a day-to-day basis. Livestock producers, you would think with lower feed cost, we'd actually be setting in tremendous shape. There's some uncertainty there as well. Recent numbers have been released in the beef sector talking about expansion, which is cyclical. One would expect that. Record number of pigs every single day, which is good and bad. And we continue to expand the dairy herd. Those particular species are not in great shape, but there's a silver lining in the cloud, I believe. First, I want to remind you about Superior Livestock Auction. Speaking of expanded cattle markets, market your cattle the Superior way. Full details about tomorrow's sale, selling 20,500 head of feeder cattle, and the full catalog can be viewed online, www.superiorlivestock.com. Don't forget, the sale can be viewed in two places, Dish Network Channel 232 or Superior Click to Bid. Either way, find your rep, superiorlivestock.com. Continued expansion of the cattle breeding herd in the neighborhood of 3% is what we are seeing. There was a report out just this week that said with the continued expansion going on 3 years now, there should be no packing capacity issues. The infrastructure is there to handle increased numbers. That's what I'm most excited about in the pig world today. We're setting record number of pigs being harvested on a day-to-day basis. We've got a new plant, Sioux City, Iowa, that is coming on board. They're operating a little bit, not what they could be. The exciting news about beef and pork to me, compared to our friends in the dairy business who are struggling and have been struggling for quite some time, is that they continue to produce more and more milk per cow, which is great news, except the infrastructure for dairy processing has not kept pace with the increased production per cow. You must have the capacity and the demand in order to market these products. We are doing that, and the future to me looks extremely bright from a beef and pork standpoint. When you can grow the numbers that we've seen in the pork sector, bring on new capacity, bring on better demand, and that always is the key. We must always focus on that, and ultimately it comes back to the corn and soybean producers. Where is the increased demand? Because at the end of the day, if the farmer does not benefit from what is happening, we're all in trouble. All of us being not in the farm sector in the United States. That's what I think's lost too often. I'm Trent Luce. Join me again on the next adventure, Luce Tales.
The seasonal chores you'll want to do right now to keep you on track for winter and spring. That's coming up on This Land of Ours.
As we await the markets to open, let's take a look at markets from yesterday. At the Mercantile Exchange, milk futures traded two-sided throughout the day and ended mixed. September milk steady at 1637, October up 6 at 1634, November down 13 at 1641, and December down 10 at 1631. In cash cheese trade, barrels were up 5 at 173. 40-pound blocks up 4 1/4 at 173 1/4. 4 cars traded for barrels, 6 for blocks. Grade A non-fat dry milk was up 1 1/4 at 84 1/4. 3 cars traded. Grade AA butter was down 0.75 cents to 241 3/4. 9 cars traded. In the livestock sector, cattle futures were higher in uneven trade throughout the day. October live cattle up 30 at 108.58. December up $1.43 at 114.90. And February up $1.23 at 118.50. September feeder cattle up $1.83 at 152.40. October up $2.05 at 152.70. And November up $2.25 at 154.53. Hog futures also saw some solid gains after echoing the cattle trade throughout the day. October lean hogs up 15 at 55.40. December up $1.55 at 59.65. And February up $1.25 at 64.40. At the Chicago Board of Trade, grains traded two-sided throughout the day. Corn futures ended the day with some gains after trading lower at opening. December corn up 1 3/4 at 354, March up 1.5 at 366 1/4, and May up 2 at 375 3/4. Soybean futures opened lower but ended the day 1 to 3 cents higher. November soybeans up 2 at 965 1/2, January up 2 1/4 at 976 1/4, and March up 2 at 985 1/2. And wheat futures shrugged off early losses to see 4 to 7 cent gains. December Chicago wheat up 7 3/4 at 461 1/2, March up 7 1/4 at 480 3/4, and May up 6 1/2 at 493 1/2. For AgNet West, I'm Martha Gingras.
Some of the chores we do during autumn will almost guarantee to keep us warm and fed during the winter months, as well as prepare us for the many gifts that await us in the spring. If you haven't thought about these little things already, you'll want to add these tasks to your autumn chores to-do list. From the simplest things, such as seed harvesting, to storing and canning fruits and veggies. Don't forget to make cider from the autumn apples and pears, including cider vinegar. Some of your outdoor autumn chores should include raking up or blowing the extra foliage, as well as getting a start on mulching. It may also be a good time to begin thinking about winterizing your home, from protecting your pipes to putting away the outdoor summer furniture and even garden hoses and other tools until next year. And last but not least, remember to get the backup power supplies ready in the event of that inevitable harsh winter storm. Autumn is also a good time to cut and gather firewood. I'm Kathy Eisen for AgNet West.
Good day, everybody. Albert J. Hernandez, the Untamed Chef for AgNet West. Welcome to the California Kitchen, where you can learn how to cook in under 3 minutes or less. I'm your host with the most. Let's get started. So day four of our recipes is my baked potato soup. I promise you, this is the best way to use leftover potatoes. But more importantly, it's just a great recipe to bring the family together and to share this with your community. So remember, this is all batch cooking this week here on the California Kitchen. So get inspired to go out and do something nice for your community, or make some soup and share it with everybody. Why not? So the first thing I need to do is we're going to take 1/4 pot of baked potatoes, and 1/4 pot typically consists of about 6 quarts of potatoes, usually in one of these bigger stock pots. I'm going to add to that 1/4 pot 3/4 gallon of heavy cream. Once I add that heavy cream, I'm going to go ahead and just stir that around. I want to make sure it gets under those potatoes, because if it sits on top of the potatoes and we turn the heat up, the bottom of the potatoes are going to burn, and we don't want that to happen. Next, I'm going to take 2 gallons of beef stock, and we want to make sure we're always using a really good beef stock or chicken stock. We don't want to be using any of this, lower cost stuff. And I know you're saving a little bit of money, but you also got to remember, really great food is as minimal ingredients as possible, just done very, very well. So what I'm going to do next, and this is really cool. Most people don't ever think to do this, because you're like, how do we get the potato soup from not being grainy or being, too starchy? Well, here's what the best thing to do. We use only waxy potatoes whenever we make soups. I don't ever use russet potatoes. But if you have leftover russet potatoes, that's fine. You just want to be careful if you add them to your soup, because we don't want those starches to break down and to break into the soup, and also to change the viscosity and all the flavors that we're working with here. So the next thing I do, once we have our stock in, our cream and our potatoes, I'm going to add a number 10 can of nacho cheese. Now, I know you're thinking, this chef did not just say nacho cheese, but I promise you, I don't eat nachos with nacho cheese. I make soups that have cheese with nacho cheese. It is out of this world. Such a great flavor. And I know everybody will love it. I'm going to add to this 1 cup of onion powder, 1 cup of granulated garlic. This is really, really important that that granulated garlic's in there, and 1 cup of Greek cut oregano. We're going to thicken this soup up with 2 quarts. You know what? I said 2 quarts, but let's be a little bit careful here because everybody makes slurry different. I'm going to do 1 quart of slurry. And remember, slurry is equal parts water and cornstarch. So that's what we're going to use to thicken up, and this is going to be amazing. For this and many more of my recipes, follow me at www.ajhtheuntamedchef.com. And as always, this is Albert J. Hernandez. You can call me the Untamed Chef for Agnet West.
For more on any of the stories you've heard here this morning, visit our website at agnetwest.com. You can also find us on Twitter at Agnet West or myself at Sabrina W. Hill. This has been Farm City News Day by Agnet West, and I am your host, Sabrina Hill. Have a wonderful day.